Here's a crazy question.
What's that?
What if there were no weeks?
Like W-E-A-K? Like no week?
No. I'm saying like the week, like how we divide our calendar into days and weeks, right?
Okay.
I was just thinking, if you're like writing a story and building a world, would it be possible to have something without weeks? Like,
I guess. I mean, you'd really have to like build up the day-to-day.
Okay, so here, I guess, what if we did a calendar? Kind of, you know how like businesses do quarterlies, you know, first quarter, second quarter, third quarter.
Yeah.
What, just as an example, like, and it's not that revolutionary, but what if you didn't have Monday to Sunday? It was just day one of the first, you know, quarter one, day one, and you went up to day 90.
I think I might go like, insane.
No, I'm saying like it's trippy though, right? Like to think about how we keep time and just like, I mean, we rely on it so much, the idea of the weekend, how we break it down. But yeah, like, I was just thinking like it didn't come ready made. Like someone had to come up with that and be like, okay, we're going to divide it into 7 days. We're going to call it this, this, and this. You know, it's just like things you take for granted a little bit that you don't think like, wow, someone actually had to, whether they knew it or not, you know, maybe not one person, but it's something that was built on over the years.
Yeah. I know, like, in the turn of the century, it was, what, Henry Ford was responsible for the 5-day work week?
Yeah.
So, I don't know, maybe a large portion of it started around there, but...
Yeah, it's just, I don't know why I was thinking about that today. I was like, you know what, what if we didn't have a 7-day week? What if it was like, what if there weren't even really months, you know? What if we divided it up differently? Or
this is the time, Han, we rise up, we break the cycle.
But I digress. I'm taken away from the main topic here.
Oof, and it is a topic.
Lay this one on. I'm looking at your notes here.
This
damn, they might even be scarier than the movie. No.
Yeah, I was going to say, there was definitely a theme when I wrote them.
Uh-huh.
This flick, The Ring, 2002, Gore Verbinski directing, shot by Bohan Bazeli.
Mm-hmm.
Beautifully shot by Bohan Bazeli, and this is
which
one of
Gore Verbinski, I think, more popularly known for Pirates of the Caribbean, right?
Yeah, that's kind of his big claim to fame these days, as people typically know him for that. He's been kicking around a couple other things. He actually redabbled in horror not long after Pirates of the Caribbean, but that wasn't received quite well. So
yeah, I'm just like for like you know that's I feel like that would be more of the household.
Yeah,
I
knew him for The Ring first. Ring is actually an adaptation of a Japanese film by the title Ringu.
Yeah.
That came out sometime before this. And
mm-hmm. This
movie not only scares the hell out of me, it interests the hell out of me.
Yeah,
I have been very obsessed with this movie for a very long time.
I remember this kicking around when it first came out and like the whole... This was, and it kind of fits with the story, this was kind of one of the first... viral movies, I guess I could remember, you know, where like, I mean, the internet's still in the infancy stages as compared to today, but it had that.
It was kind of like the first home video market subject matter movie, because the home video market had been around for, in real consumable sense, for about a decade at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, when this was coming up, I mean, Blockbuster was still king of the rentals. I mean, video rentals were still king.
Yeah. It was kind of like the last heyday of Blockbuster where still around. It wasn't a couple years after that they started to decline, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, the concept of this movie on paper sounds terrible, but it's all in the execution of it that it all comes together.
Which goes to show you, I've always said, it depends, like... Ideas don't make the artist, artists make the ideas.
Exactly.
I'm a huge believer in that. Because if you give a bad idea to a good artist, you're generally going to get a decent execution, a decent thing. Something good is going to come out.
It's kind of yin and yang. You can have a genius idea and it's only kind of shine through with a bad artist. Or you can have a terrible idea and a genius artist make it really good.
But you give a bad idea or good idea to someone who is not as learned or practiced or doesn't care, it's going to fall apart.
Yeah. To give a brief synopsis of what the film is actually about, Rachel Keller is an investigative journalist who's looking into this quote-unquote high school rumor about a videotape that kills you allegedly when you watch it. Seven days following when you watch it to the exact minute from when you watched it, actually. And as it turns out, through her learning more about this, it's actually tied to the death of a young girl that is shrouded in mystery, not a lot known about it. So she takes it upon herself to try and find more about it. And she comes to believe more and more that this curse is actually real, following her actually watching the tape and experiencing the elements of the curse itself. The film actually takes place in Seattle, Washington, as well as Moesco Island.
Was going back to, I looked through, I found, it took some digging, but I found the original American Cinematographer magazine article on this, which is kind of the only source of information that you can find directly from Bohan Bozzelli about some of his processes and how they did this. And it's one of those things, like, this movie launched a visual look that was emulated for well past a decade following this.
Yeah, yeah. What look are we talking about? This visual, because this is your wheelhouse when we come to the cinematography.
That's fair.
I only know the basics. I could maybe pass a written test, but if you ask me to actually do it,
we give you a driver's test, but for cinematography.
Yeah, I'd be like, Brian, get the thingy.
We get Cody over here. He tells you to go get the duckbill clamps.
The duckbill clamps or the Johnny Rockets. Yes.
Yeah. that all story was so good. But yeah, I looked this up and I found that American Cinematographer article, and weirdly enough, it's kind of like the NHL. It's like they put Pierce Brosnan and James Bond, Die Another Day of all James Bond movies, has the cover over top of this. And I think that this is the standout piece of cinematography.
Yeah.
I do strongly wish that this one was on the cover, but that's not the case. Yeah. Bozzelli had like a very interesting process. Once it's taken a long time for it to fully come to light of people like actually trying to like backwards engineer it, but he used a very rare piece of film stock. Actually, it's Kodak EXR200T, and this particular film stock was actually retired in 2004. You can no longer get it.
Oh, okay.
Some people have found similar stocks from like third parties, like that are not Kodak, that are close enough that they're able to do some tests and show you. But unless you got it when it was still around, you can't.
Well, there you go, right there too. Like, I mean, film stock in general, is that still as prevalent now, or is a lot of it, I think,
it's become the gold standard, I think, and it's so rare that it is sought after so hard, and it's, you know, there were a billion different styles of film stock back in the day. It's like the picking and choosing and what you used and to execute your look was everything. Yeah. Now it's like you can kind of digitally emulate a lot of different kinds of things, but it's not quite the same thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The amount of work it would take to fully replicate it in digital is so absurd that no one does that. And that would be just to emulate one film stock.
Yeah, it's almost like the moon conspiracy. Like, it would just be easier to actually go to the moon than try to fake it.
Exactly, yeah. But in this particular case, they're trying to read through back here, because it was a very complicated process. And I have some links and stuff I'll put in the description below as far as like the technicals of this. I don't want to go on too much of a cinematography nerd rant. As they say in the movie, they're like, for someone who doesn't read Video Geek magazine, as Rachel says to Noah, that's part of it too, is like to get to like the thematics of it, shooting on film and the nature of like the complex processes that they went through to achieve the look of the film lends itself to the tangibility quality of a lot of the elements of the story itself. Like, it bleeds into like how they made the film and in the subject matter of the film itself. So it's like film processing and like video handling, all that stuff like is intrinsic to the story itself and the research nature of like what Rachel and Noah are going through. And as it bleeds down to how the film itself was made, it lends into this like cyclical interest for anybody like enthusiast of that nature kind of stuff. So that's where my Video Geek Nerd magazine comes out. As I literally reference a Video Geek Nerd magazine. Yeah, Bozzelli's notes were kind of crazy. He did a post-pull process too. He like had them, in processing the film, actually underexpose the film by like a full stop, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. And by full stop, you are referring to
like, that's the level to which the amount of light that's let through.
That's coming through, yeah.
You measure in terms of stops. And it's also too, like, the big thing with this was the whole entire look of this film was achieved in camera. They did do some light post-processing, but the thing was, like, they achieved with I keep referring to the look, the green teal tone to the film that's over across like all the photography. You can once you've seen the film, you can notice it immediately. It's like everything has that like tealish wet kind of feel to it.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
that's all achieved by how they filtered the lenses, what lenses they chose, the film stock that was used, lightly so in the post-processing, but mostly this is achieved in camera, which is not what's done today at all.
No, and I can remember this, I mean, it was 2002, so this is right smack dab in Lord of the Rings coming out.
Yeah, it was actually just a few months after, if memory serves. Yeah,
and that was the first movie I can remember actually, or at least seen in the behind the scenes, where they started doing digital, like white balances and changing the color. Now they would have to do it where they'd have to take the film, scan it digitally, put it in the computer, and then spit it back out onto film.
At the risk of going on a tangent a bit, Lord of the Rings paid for that quite heavily, and it wasn't until the most recent remaster, I would say, that they finally got a lock on a lot of that stuff. Because there was a lot of contested visuals there from post-processing,
just to go off what you said, that's impressive to think how they did this in the old school way to get the look that they wanted.
And I think, like I said before, it lends itself to that tangibility in the research, in the videotape itself, in the film. Like there's a lot of like tangible quality things that just come to the forefront of the story. And what I think is so interesting in it being a ghost story and a mystery, you have all these tangible elements, and what they're fighting is the inherently intangible.
Yeah.
Which I've one of the things I find so interesting about the movie itself.
Mm-hmm.
No, one of the signature filters that they use is known as the 81EF. At least as it's referred to. Now, see, there's
the
81EF.
That sounds like a bad.
You made that up, didn't you?
That sounds like a bad 90s infomercial for a workout routine. The 81EF. Get ripped by this summer.
Get ripped.
But continue, yeah.
But it, what it is, it's a color temperature adjustment filter. It actually decreases the color temperature, and what it's designed for is offsetting for tungsten light. So you kind of cheat. Like it's a filter that's designed to kind of cheat color temperature, you know, before the days of digital color processing, which, you know, most situations for like commercials and stuff anymore, you wouldn't even bat an eye at trying to do that optically. You just do it in post.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, everything now is done so quickly.
Which digitally. You know, is partly problematic in modern filmmaking, because, as you know, from the perspective of a DP, like, you know, when everything can be achieved digitally, it's taken right out of your hands after the fact, and everybody just plays with it in post. Where it's, you know, when you're baking it into the footage and there is no other way, there's something to be said, I think, for such a discerned choice to be made visually.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the case very much with this film, is like they did it all in camera. All the look of this was incredibly intentional from the word go. And nowadays we have a bit of a crisis of choices, I would say.
Well, no, yeah, and this is not to say that, at least I don't think either one of us is like completely anti-digital or computer.
No, not at all. Almost everything I do is digital.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, without it, where the hell would we be? But there is something to be said about actually trying to light the scene and actually shoot it on the day, and instead of relying on the post-production as a crutch. Maybe it is used a lot more now, or maybe that's just the way it can be now, but
all of the choices surrounding the look of the film itself were very well thought out, very heavily researched, but most importantly very deliberate. But I think like there's something to be said for analog, in which you are making very definitive choice. It definitely puts the burden on the front end of things and doing the research beforehand, but it saves you on the back end, whereas you've already made those choices and it's locked in place. Whereas if you do things digitally, sometimes it can be the case that you're doing a lot of sweeping things under the rug in the post process and trying to figure out the look, or, you know, what you're trying to do after the fact.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a case to be made for both sides of this, but neither here nor there. This very deep, deep process we can boil down to filters, choices of film stock, and lenses. They shot this on the Cook S4s, as well as some Zeiss Super Speeds. And I did read and pick up that they picked up an Ingenue 12-1 zoom lens, rather rare French lens. Well, not super rare, but they did that for some of the key zoom shots, and I thought that that was interesting. They didn't rely solely on primes, which was typically the case in the 2000s. Like the old 70s-style zoom was kind of pushed off.
And by prime lenses, we are talking about lenses that don't have the zoom function.
They have no zoom capability. They literally lock and play.
Yeah. Now, the benefit of those, the double-edged sword is, benefit of those, they have less lens elements. Correct me if I'm wrong here.
No, that's true. Yeah.
But they allow for a better light capturing of the light. You get a better picture.
Yeah. Typically is the case too. Not always. So it depends on the build, but a lot of lens builds can allow higher intake of light. Mm-hmm. With a prime. With a zoom lens, it kind of forces the mechanics to the place where the aperture can't open quite as wide. For like I said, yeah. there's exceptions to this, but in a lot of cases. But this is not a cinematography episode. We'll do that another time. We'll go down that rabbit hole now.
Not a cinematography episode. What? Did you read your notes?
Yeah, I did. I did. I wrote a whole page. I wrote an entire page just on the cinematography of this movie because I love it that much. But yeah, the last little bit. He did favor mostly medium style lenses, like within the range of the 32 to 50 mm. Just to kind of keep things, like that's kind of like known as like a standard, keep things in like the main character's perspective kind of focal range. So good on him. He's a dude who knows his business for sure.
So when by that you're saying like, I hadn't seen the movie in a bit, but you're saying like keep it away from real wide masters or like extreme close-ups.
It's just, it has, depending on, you know, like what you're, this all changes with whatever format you're recording in. So like mm-hmm. if you're in Panavision 65 versus 35 versus IMAX, like all these numbers mean different things. So it's the case, like most commonly, if you're shooting with lenses that are built for that format, it's that within the 32 to 50 range typically tends to be like what the perspective is of like an in-person view of things.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, I would let's move on to the actual movie itself, because I could seriously go down a cinematography rabbit hole for hours especially on this one. The story of this one has always freaked me the hell out.
Freaked out a lot of people.
Yeah. I saw this movie. It was one of those ones I saw when I was way too young. I definitely should not have seen this when I was... I literally did not sleep for a week after the first time I saw this. My teachers were actually starting to get legitimately concerned about me.
There'd be an interesting... How many people lost sleep over watching this movie back when it first came out?
Yeah. And I would put this definitely on a pantheon of ghost films. Like, this is, like, way up there. No, I would actually... But, like, not to jump the gun, but I would put this in some of my top favorite of all time, honestly.
No, that's fair, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's definitely...
It's one of those ones for me... It just fires on all cylinders. From the editing perspective, mm-hmm. the story is incredibly sound. It is directed incredibly well. Like, unquestionably, it has a visual look that has been tried to be copied for decades now.
Yeah.
So it's just one of those ones that just stands the hell out for me. Especially its editing, like I'll also jump the gun a little bit. Its editing style is so incredibly unique because it's dealing, like the intrinsic nature in the story of using the videotape, and the videotape is at the centerfold of everything. They use that to the editing advantage and they splice in single frames of the tape, like really pounding home that these images are like burned into your main character's mind.
Yeah.
It's just, there's something so genius about that. And I, like, a lot of people didn't even notice that was occurring. Like, they were starting to, like, get subliminal imaged, like, behind the film itself. And, like, I think that's part of what makes it so traumatizing is, like, you really do feel like you're something is worming its way in your brain.
Yeah. And, well, so, pitch me the movie here. Set the scene for me.
Start of the film, actually, it kind of creeps you out right from the word go. It starts with Rachel's niece. Yeah. It starts with Rachel's niece. Katie, and it's like a typical like Friday night hangout, mm-hmm. or I guess it would be Saturday night hangout given the nature of the story. They're talking about how signals and stuff are there's all these inherent unknowns to like TV signals, and that starts off on a creepy tone because then you start thinking, oh well, there is what is the murkiness of all these signals that are flying through the air?
Yeah, like a white noise type deal.
Yeah, it gets you back on like a conspiratorial note right from the word go. Yeah. And slowly through deep composition and things, while these two girls are hanging out on a Friday night, we start to get the sense that something's wrong. We learn that Katie, the previous weekend, had spent a night up with her friend, her boyfriend from another school,
in a cabin in upstate Washington.
And that's where the classic nature of the tape,
you know, as you do.
You know, as
is
you
that
do.
Why you go to? Is that why you go to Maine all the time?
Hey,
I
like
what
Maine.
You're doing.
Actually, this movie might be why I do love this movie. But yeah, so they roundabout way, she is killed by an unseen force. The TV clearly involved. There's water. A lot of deep composition in the photography that really plays well to the style of horror. And what's, I think, even creepier is slowly through that entire sequence, Becca just kind of, her friend who's over for the evening, just kind of disappears slowly.
Yeah.
Almost to the point where you don't even notice it happen. And you get the sense that there's this malevolent presence there. Something is after her up until the point that she is killed. And then it cuts directly to one of our protagonists, Rachel's son, Aiden.
Well, yeah, that is a good use of the cold open, if you will, I think, story-wise. You know, because I don't think, other than the main reveal of the ghost, if you will, I don't think those characters are in any way related to the protagonist, were they?
Katie, the one who was killed, is Rachel's niece.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Never mind.
Because her sister is the mother. And
her sister, she.
She would babysit Aiden. That was like their main like immediate social connection. But beyond that, they were actually related. Yeah. Katie dies, and then it sends a rift through their family. They attend her funeral, and there, a lot of weird occurrences start to show up. You see that Katie was like scratching out the faces in a notebook of all the pictures and drawing circles. A lot of very strange things that seemed off. Rachel gets.
It's a ghost story.
Yeah, Rachel finds a series of
or a monster movie, depending on what you.
That's what I kind of love about this one too. Is it's a multi-genre thing. It's kind of a mystery, ghost story, horror story, monster story. Like there's a lot of different elements to this one. But yeah, Rachel finds a photo receipt. She goes retrieves the photos, and they are all developed strangely. All the people in the photograph have show up distorted, and something's clearly wrong. And as we learn, that's part of this curse that comes on to these characters through watching the tape.
Yeah.
And I was actually discussing this with a friend of mine. He had brought up a term I had not heard before, this is a movie, amongst others, that includes what he referred to as a basilisk mechanic, which I found interesting. Anybody knows the lore behind a basilisk? It's something that you can't look at it, or it'll turn you to stone or paralyze you, or a lot of different versions in the legend. But, movies like this, like if you see the element, this in this case being Samara or the curse itself, the tape, you're damned, you're cursed. Another example of this is Bird Box, or hilariously enough, he brought up in Monty Python, there's one element in Flying Circus, they use the joke that is so funny, if you hear it causes you to die from laughter. So there's one that uses it for a comedic endeavor. Shout out to Donnie for that one. And what I find interesting about that is the inherent nature and the importance put on photography in this movie. That old tale, that old legend that having your photo steals a portion of your soul.
Yeah.
I think by that token, there's something very inherently creepy about being unable to be photographed.
Say that again? Say that like creepy about...
I think there's something very creepy about the inability to be photographed.
The inability
to be photographed.
What are you talking about not being photographed? Like a person not being photographed, or?
Yeah, so like in the movie.
Yeah.
Part of the curse is you can't because be photographed.
I see what you're saying. Oh, yeah. When something's not. Yeah. Why did the photo?
Yeah. And it's part of this curse that it's almost like Samara has claimed your soul.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's like that little, kind of not a spin, but similar to like how vampires don't have you can't see a reflection.
Yeah, it's almost building its own set of lore in that way, and I think that that's very, very cool about this movie. To give a bit about our main characters too, we meet Aiden, we meet Rachel. Rachel's an investigative journalist. Aiden is her son. Aiden comes off as a little bit creepy. He's dealing with Katie's death a little too well. But the first we see Rachel too, she's being called into a meeting with her son's teacher, who expresses that there's some concerns with Aiden's drawings. And we think that, something's wrong with this kid. But that's not the case.
It's always the quiet ones.
It's always the quiet ones. And Aiden is a very interesting character in that he's a very self-reliant young kid, and there's a bit of a role reversal in a couple of scenes where he's actually taking up the role and helping Rachel get her day started, and there's some interesting role reversal play between parent and adult.
But two, as we learn, like the sources of all these different kinds of images that are showing up for people affected by the tape are being put there by Samara.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's also something very inherently creepy about, for instance, this first scene where we see Aiden and he's making drawings which seem very creepy or psychologically disturbed potentially, but in reality, it's coming from some other entity. Something else is putting disturbing images inside of you,
And it's like everybody else is going to perceive that as you being crazy.
Yeah.
So I think that there's something very disturbing about that too. Somebody being able to affect you on that level.
Well, yeah, not having, you know, control over your own wits. I mean, is just,
yeah,
can be horrifying.
And too, like as the story progresses, as Rachel, you know, as she is a investigative journalist, she starts digging and trying to find more information. She finds out that the other three kids that Katie went to the cabin died at the exact same time that she did. And there's no medical explanation for how Katie died.
Mm-hmm.
Her heart just suddenly stopped. So it's all very puzzling. As Rachel digs more and more, she finds she makes a copy of the tape, and which leads her to certain elements of the tape. She tracks down the lighthouse, which appears within the tape.
Which I remember too, when this came out on, I think, the DVD.
Yeah.
They, like, you could play and watch the actual tape on it, you know?
Well, the other thing that's really cool too, I read this in my stuff that I pulled up for Bazelli. They made four different copies of the tape, like four different prints of the tape for different purposes photographically, which I thought was so cool, because they made them, you know, obviously for different monitors, different purposes like that. But also they had at least one of them was brightened to the level just to project onto the actors' faces. So they were actually watching the tape. It wasn't just like they put a light with a flicker effect on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were actually watching a version of the tape, which was reflecting into their faces, but was just amped up, you know, for lighting purposes to be bright enough. But so that they could get the proper reactions out of the actors. Also that when you see the reflections in the actors' faces, you are actually seeing those images.
Okay.
And I'm like, that's all very, very cool photographic witchcraft that I love.
Yeah. All into the service of the story, I'm assuming.
Yeah, totally. Because, you know, you're getting very realistic reactions from the cast. You're getting accurate imagery that plays very believably. Another element that they did by a similar token, at the risk of going down another production spiral, they did build the apartments on stages. But what they did was the backdrops were not CGI. They made photographic panoramas.
All right.
It was called a translite backdrop that they did. And
I've actually never heard that term before.
It's a version of rear projection. It's where they...
Oh, okay. All right.
It's similar, but not totally the same as rear projection. What they did was they had a very gigantic photograph that they made from high-res stills stitched together.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they'll light that from behind to create the illusion that it's like across the street in a city backdrop.
Yeah. And rear projection is just that old classic thing of, like, you see it a lot, like, with car scenes, driving scenes they did back in the old day where the car is really stationary, but then the screen behind it is, you know, playing a film.
Yeah. In this case, it's just a still image, but they did some clever techniques because I know they show Rachel's apartment at night. And mm-hmm. they took individual bulbs and, like, lit behind the apartments specifically to light the windows and did a lot of cool things with that. So a lot of cool stuff. I urge digging into that and checking it out for anybody interested. But as far as the story as well, going back, I think that this is one of the pantheons of research. Partly why I love it so much. You know how much I love to research things. Characters that actually take an interest in researching things is going to hit a chord with me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think having an investigative journalist as a protagonist in a horror movie is a very interesting place to be. It's certainly not, you know, exclusive to this movie. Others have definitely done that. I think that those elements are used to very effective use in this movie. Two, that we're kind of led down this spiral to kind of believe through almost the first half of the movie that Anna Morgan and her husband are actually the antagonist.
Yeah.
Which, and then there's this incredible, like, 180 spin. It's actually separate points of the movie. You kind of, like, slowly led down that spiral. And I think as an audience member, you're a little more attuned to it, the true nature of all of this, before mm-hmm. the characters are. And I think that that's intentional.
I would think so, yeah. I would think, because we've talked about before, dramatic irony, just the concept of the audience knowing more than the characters is always it's one of the writer's bread and butters.
Yeah.
At least in filmmaking.
Well, they also, they achieve this on a couple of different storytelling levels. I think the first that they do it with is the family unit. So we find out downstream, there is spoilers ahead, that Aiden is actually Noah's son, and that he and Rachel used to be in a relationship, so they are kind of a broken family unit,
mm-hmm.
which makes for a very interesting journey for them all to go on together, because you have this hope that they will build back and get back together and find some semblance of a happy life together. But also, like, it's kind of mirrored by the fact that we find out that the Morgan family was split apart and separated. So we get a bit of a mirrored look into our protagonist's life through their horrific situation in the past, as we slowly learn more and more about it.
There's kind of reminds me sometimes, like we've mentioned before, like Big Chill, or Ordinary People. You have that normal like family melodrama thing going on, but you have the supernatural element twisted in.
Yeah. Well, too, any medium or any genre of storytelling you're getting into, pulling things in like that and allowing it to kind of be the pad or the buffer to a more supernatural or a more otherwise otherworldly piece of storytelling can be very can make it very palatable and very grounded and connectable to an audience. Too, back to what I was saying before about the tangibility of everything, in the research of everything, like going into all these paper records, the microfiche, all the different levels of newspaper that they sift through, trying to find out the history of the Morgan family and what actually happened to them, lends itself to this tangibility of everything. And what they ultimately find out that they're fighting is the inherently intangible in the form of this little girl who is no longer alive. She is now... She's mostly been unchained and freed to wreak terror wherever she so chooses. And she's reaching out slowly and trying to get people to hear her message.
Mm-hmm.
She's actually no longer bound to a physical body, but is still somewhat trapped within this captured world of below the well.
We find out that she was imprisoned in an institution when she was a young girl, and her adopted parents were trying to understand more about what the hell was going on with her. The Morgans were very clearly terrorized by something. They repeatedly state that every time they were around Samara, that they felt that there were images being burned inside of them.
Mm-hmm.
A very terrible imagery. And that's kind of our first clue as an audience member that something ain't right with this little kid.
Well, I remember the story does a good job of laying out the pieces of what, like the foreshadowing. I think this does a really good job of foreshadowing.
Yeah, in a way that it doesn't make it so blatantly apparent to the the protagonists.
Noah, we get the sense he's a very skilled photographer and videographer based upon the little elements we get of his know-how and some of the tangible things that are surrounding him in his apartment. He's very grounded in reality. He takes things at very face value, doesn't really believe in the supernatural. It takes some serious convincing for him to get on board with the understanding of the curse. And it's heavily implied, you know, through the break in his relationship with Rachel that he quote-unquote needs to grow up, and that leads to some great character development throughout the course of the film for his character. Rachel is an investigative journalist. She goes and describes herself as somebody that's not easily rattled, but she very quickly comes to the realization of how dire her situation is within having latched herself onto this curse. And we get the sense that the relationship with Noah and Rachel has some hope. They're building towards something up until the tragic situation where Noah succumbs to the curse and he actually becomes one of the victims, despite the fact that they thought that they had gotten past it and had reconciled and gotten a future.
The cast in this is pretty stellar as well. Some of the minor roles.
There's a lot of decent people in this. I had kind of forgotten.
Yeah.
Truly a well brought together cast of actors, you know, between Naomi Watts and Martin Henderson leading the cast, with young David Dorfman as a relatively first timer. And of course, Brian Cox and a lot of other the rest of the cast, including Amber Tamblyn, who was also in 127 Hours, Rachel Bella, and Dave Chase, who played Samara in this. She was also in Spirited Away in the English cast.
In the early scene at the funeral for Katie, the boy who's like over talking everything and giving a lot of information about the tape, the big high school rumor as it is at that point, the actor who plays that guy is Adam Brody. He was on a couple of like teen throb shows through the early 2000s and stuff, but
the teen throb, the 90210s, the Dawson's Creek,
the OCs,
the Sunday Night Blues or something like that. Wasn't that one of them?
Something like that.
I'm trying to think. The classic late 90s, early 2000s
big common storytelling.
Yeah.
But he did another film more recently that I really love called Kid Detective. Have you seen that one?
I have not, but I've heard good things.
Definitely going to lend it to you. The doctor on Moesco Island, Dr. Grasnick, she played in All the President's Men.
Hey, very good movie.
Another very good movie.
And very good, speaking of cinematography, another good shot movie.
Gordon Willis is the GOAT, dude.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just to give another moment, since we're dipping back into technicals, the score of this is just absolutely haunting. I couldn't get the score of this out of my mind for years. I still can't get it out of my mind.
I mean, you're talking about it now.
Even though he wasn't one of the forefront composers on it, this is one of the scores that launched Hans Zimmer into another stratosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Tillman is largely credited as like the guy who bound a lot of it together, but this was one of the more like even collaborations between a number of different composers, so they kind of pretty equally shared the workload.
Yeah, which is, I think,
Viara Trench also involved pretty great as well.
That's pretty rare for a movie to have that many hands in them when it comes to the music.
Yeah, and I think it shows too, because it is utterly dark and haunting, and it feeds through to the nature of drowning and water is very apparent in the sound design and the score, but also that signature look that we were discussing with the cinematography also kind of implies, you know, water and a sense of drowning. Like, mm-hmm. You're surrounded by this teal look of the film. It's like you're surrounded by water. So it all kind of like leads towards the same bits of storytelling. And I it's like everything is like known to you implicitly from the beginning, but you just don't have like the full context of it yet.
Well, yeah. And a good nod to using the symbols to sort of upend them, you know, normally with the concept of water or blue, you think more lighthearted, you think like the beach, you think summertime, you think more comfort, usually when you think of like just water and that color. And here they do, and they take it,
they spin
and,
like, it on
like
its
horror
head.
Yeah, how horror tends to do, take something like that and spins it on its head, like you said, which inherently, I will admit, I don't know why doing that makes it good essentially. And just like when any time, like, I'm not saying that like simply taking something and turning it on its head automatically makes it good, but because you still got to execute it properly.
Well, what I think the core of that is horrific situations, mm-hmm. Dark entities or of any kind will take something and turn it against you. Something that you think is peaceful, they'll use it as an element of fear.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, and that, what I love about that too, is it cuts both ways. Like, you can, like how people can reclaim a fear from themselves and make it something peaceful. Yeah. There are a lot of films about that, like taking something back and making something that you're afraid of, something that can comfort you. So, I mean, I love that sword cuts both ways.
Well, yeah, just that concept of having a character master their fear is, I mean, it's a simple concept, but it works well in stories.
Yeah, like both ways. Like, you can make something that should be very peaceful utterly terrifying and can really like make you lose an entire week of sleep and traumatize you for the next 22 years.
This is a podcast, not an intervention, Brian.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I think too, we talked about tangibility and the nature of signals. I think that intangibility can be very terrifying. You know, what we don't know is out there. Like, you know, there's a hell of a lot more like signals flying through the air now than there were in 2002. So,
no, yeah, uncertainty is inherently a scary thing, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you go back to like more primitive times. We're still hunter-gatherers and tribes. I mean, at night, you didn't know what was in the dark, but mostly anything that was in the dark wanted to eat you.
Blair Witch Project.
Yeah.
Brah. Yeah, that's shot two of Samara, where she's in the clinic, she's in the institution, and they have a camera on her room, and she's just not sleeping, standing up. They have run the time lapse, the clock, running around the clock, and she's just like standing there.
Mm-hmm.
Just terrifies me.
Well, it's that like that uncanny valley concept, you know. It's it's just slightly off enough that it disturbs you.
Yeah. We come to learn that Samara is from very mysterious origins. There's not a lot of known about what her biological parents were like or who they were. We get a sense that she honed her ability for this broadcasting, her transient ability to put images in people's heads through the course of her being kept in the loft of the barn. There's a TV that's kept there, and it's kind of implied that the only thing she had to occupy her time was to hone this ability. And too, like, I found some, when I was like researching this too, I was looking at it like more pragmatic view. I was looking at it too, like from the perspective of John Carpenter's Halloween,
mm-hmm.
how you have both of these movies depict a child as being inherently evil. And I was like, there's something just supremely terrifying about like a lack of motivation for somebody wanting to kill you.
Oh, yeah.
Like this little girl and both Michael Myers in the John Carpenter's Halloween just inherently want to kill people for no seemingly apparent reason.
Yeah, when something doesn't have that
something that can't be reasoned with, something that you can't like crack your way into understanding it.
Yeah,
it just wants to kill you. There's something extremely terrifying about that.
Like, yeah, it's just a natural, you know, like a storm. You get into like a bad storm or a flood. It has no. It's just doing what it does.
Compounded too by like being a child. Like they should be a blank slate, but like it is. There are cases in which like kids just snapped and did terrible things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like where does that come from?
I don't know. You'd have to check the healthcare for that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do we get dental yet, Brian?
No, not yet. I'm working on it.
All right.
Another classic trope in horror as well, like this follows quite beautifully, is the false, I guess you'd call it false rescue or the false salvation mm-hmm. at the end where, you know, you think your characters have solved the mystery or, you know, fixed the problem or gotten out of danger. And we're left to believe that, you know, we're in the epilogue of the story. We're on the downturn. Everything's resolved. And Rachel tells Aiden that she helped Samara and they let her free. And he goes, "What? You helped her? Why did you do that?" And it's one of the greatest lines in all of horror. "Don't you understand, Rachel? She never sleeps." That line has haunted me for years.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'll ever get it out of my head.
No, clearly not.
Yeah.
So this is why you don't sleep.
Yes, no, this is largely why I don't sleep. All this, the build of energy and the build of urgency, once Rachel realizes that Aiden's curse has not left him, which means Noah's probably at risk, she's trying to get a hold of him, she rushes mm-hmm. over there and finds out that he's already dead, he's been killed, and we actually see the emergence of Samara, and I think it's one of the most terrifying sequences. They actually have her crawl out of, it's become infamous at this point that she crawls out of the television.
Yeah.
But I think the effects work on that sequence. Just, I love Noah's apartment as well. We said before how I just kind of relate to the video geek nerd. He's living in like the early 2000s total analog world where he has all this great stuff that I'll never get my hands on. I know you said it's been a bit since you've seen this, but where does this one stand for you? Like, where would you rank it in terms of horror?
In terms of horror, I mean, definitely up there. I mean, this captured, like I said, when this came out and before social media, this definitely got big the old way by just word of mouth. And I would definitely have to rank it. It's definitely, like you said, in the pantheon. Of horror movies. But, a really good thing of foreshadowing. Like I said, if I was trying to teach stuff on another plant and payoff, you know, real good planting and paying off. The tone is perfect all the way through. Like you said, with how they shot it and the color grade to it, I think that goes along with the tone of the story. You know, you know right from the beginning what you're getting into. It's not, well, I ordered steak and I really wanted fish or something.
Yeah, it's self-aware of itself and knows what it is. I think it's one of the, I think it is growing cult, like classic status at this point. At least, maybe that's, mm-hmm. you know, a biased point of view, but I personally would say. Oh, it's
definitely at least that. Yeah, definitely.
I would call it a modern classic at this point, because it just, especially just from the cinematography itself, but let alone the incredible score and the editing style of it, I think it's just such a unique gem.
Yeah. No, I've never seen was there a sequel to this?
There are actually two sequels to this, and each more terrible than the previous.
Well, sometimes too. I also did. I would get this confused at the time with. Do you remember The Grudge? Mm-hmm. Like,
interestingly enough, they are both adapted from the same source material.
Oh, they are. Okay, so that's why I would get them confused at times.
There are multiples, actually. There was, I think it's Deep Water is another one that's also adapted from. There's like three or four.
Yeah.
They're all like from, this is definitely. Well, this,
you successful. Think about it too. This was a time when like water was like, I'm thinking of another movie like What Lies Beneath that came out in like 2000.
I love that movie. That movie also scared the living hell out of me.
Robert Zemeckis directed it. I think it was Robert Zemeckis.
He directed it too.
And that's another thing where water plays a big element. You got the, you know, the cooler colors, and when we say cooler, you talked about color temperature. That's simply just meaning like when you get like reds and oranges and yellows, those are warmer colors. Mm-hmm. And blues, purples,
teals, and greens.
Teals and are more considered cooler, their temperature. And yeah, to use that to, I'm thinking about that. There were a lot of movies in the early 2000s that had that used that a lot in, or at least the concept of water and blue.
I do think that this one horrifying kept the ball rolling. The look, at, like we talked about the visual look of this, definitely, like this started a trend that, like, it was so, like, people really tried to copy it. And as you know, digital film rose, people mm-hmm. tried doing it through like post-processing digital most commonly, but people like for the longest time just couldn't quite get it there. Like it wasn't quite the same quality. And that's why I think that this one kind of reigns supreme for such a long time, because everybody was trying desperately to copy it, but not getting quite there.
No, agreed.
But yeah, I truly cannot say enough about this one. It really is in like my top films, if not my top film researched.
I
every time I think I've gotten to the bottom of the barrel with this one, I keep diving back in and finding more. Especially I like that too, as I uncovered that American Cinematographer article, I found a lot of little interesting little gems about the way that they achieve that look in camera. I like just knowing that they didn't, you know, like do any photochemical processes after the fact to achieve that. Like it was all purely in filters
and
stock. Like that's just supremely impressive.
That is an impressive, I will say, to do that in camera.
Yeah, and to make such a lasting look that people were still trying to emulate 22 years later, that's absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, right down to the storytelling, to make such a skilled adaptation of a Japanese, already notorious Japanese horror film, like,
mm-hmm.
and to honestly, in my humble opinion, upstage it a little bit.
Yeah. I've never seen the original one, the Japanese, the Ringu, but...
It is good. It is not as good as Verbinski's, in my personal opinion, but it is very good.
Fair enough.
Fun little fact, too. We talked a bit about the sequel, The Ring 2, mm-hmm. even though Verbinski did not direct it. They brought in Hideo Nakata, who directed Ringu, to direct the sequel.
Ah.
Which came with some interesting choices.
As they always do.
Yeah. But I don't hate the sequel. I just definitely don't love it as much as the first.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely, if you've somehow evaded this movie over the last 22 years, definitely give it a shot. Growing classic, definitely earning its place in the history of film. A lot of different elements, the score, the sound design, the cinematography, direction, storytelling, all perfect, in my opinion.
Take some allergy pills. You'll be good.
Take a couple days off. Have a drink. We're genuinely worried about you, Brian.